This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is the 19th of February.
Can you even believe it?
Big week, beautiful Lunar New Year, and Ramadan.
Yes, so, and Black History Month.
And Black History Month. What else has happened this week?
I think
probably coming into the
coming into the new year, feeling hot, sexy, cool, strong.
Yes, that's right. If you feel like you had a bit of a false start on the 1st of January, this week's your chance to restart.
Absolutely. Coming in, the real fire start. Horse.
Yes.
And I saw something that said that horses retain their strength because they're also gentle and they preserve their energy. And I thought that was really beautiful.
I love that. And yeah. I also love videos that suggest that horses can read when they press all of those different buttons. And I won't be told otherwise. I think they can read. I think they can do math. And if you want to debate that, you can catch me outside 3CR, 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy. It is subscriber drive at 3CR. So make sure that you are subscribed to the station. It's not the same as donating. It's not the same as Radiothon.
As much as we appreciate it. But yes. Subscribing's like, pow-wow.
Exactly. It is you becoming a part, a registered part of the 3CR community. In terms of vibe, you're already part of the 3CR community. But what if you were also financially part of the 3CR
community? We've been doing casual for a while. What if we make it official? What if we have a say? Equal say?
Exactly. What if you join the Station Worker and Subscriber Committee, which is something that you can do and have a voice in 3CR governance if you subscribe? There are a range of different prices. We've got $40 concession, $80 waged. And then if you're a band or organization, you can pay $150. And you're also more than welcome, if you're feeling very generous, to pay $300 as a solidarity subscription. And to subscribe, you can visit 3cr.org.au or call 94198377.
Yes. Amazing. And I was going to do an impersonation of a really good guitar riff for a band and organization. But that was just something I wanted to put out into the universe, because my Lunar New Year resolution is to be a bit more cringe.
Okay, amazing. Well, this is the platform to test it out on. We have a packed show, though.
Today. I know. No more horsing around.
No more horsing around. That's right. We are going to start off with a rebroadcast of part of an exclusive Michael West Media interview with human rights lawyer Chris Sidoti on Israeli President Herzog's recent visit to Australia.
And then we will speak to Matt Ruschel, who is the Executive Director of Victorian National Parks Association, who joins us for part two of our interview about how the Victorian government has introduced legislation to dismantle key institutions that protect habitats and wildlife. So basically, they have like added so many government institutions and left it to like one sole person, which has a devastating impact for nature safeguards. But you can listen to part one on Wednesday Brekkie. And in this part, we'll talk to Matt about the impact of these cuts.
Yeah, it's a very like terrifying but also interesting thing to track, looking at, for example, other areas of government cutbacks. So Vic Health and preventative health measures, and then Sustainability Victoria, which is also sort of about preventative approaches. One wonders when what will happen when we are only left with frontline crisis services, and we are just jumping from crisis to crisis instead of doing anything to build our capacity and resilience to live. After that, we are joined by Dr. Islam El-Habil, who is a Gazan engineer and Malaysia-based microplastics specialist. And Dr. El-Habil spoke with me earlier this week about the silent cumulative harm that's caused by the breakdown of plastic waste in Gaza during the ongoing genocide. And she authored a brilliant article published on the Electronic Intifada titled The Toxic Legacy of Genocide. And we talk about how beyond the immediate destruction of Israel's bombardment, there's also the everyday environmental health impacts of the total breakdown of Gaza's waste management and plastic recycling capabilities. So this was a really, really important conversation. I hope you stay tuned.
Yes, really looking forward to that. And then I'll be joined by Josh Fear, the National Policy Director of Palliative Care Australia, talking about the latest calls to expand the new Commonwealth PRAC payment to end placement poverty for medical and allied health students. Now, the PRAC payment is expanding to cover nursing, midwifery, teaching, social work, but we unpack why it's so important for it to cover medical and allied health students. This comes after a recent survey showing that 42% of health students on placement went hungry.
And then finally, today we're going to be joined by Cassie Derrick, who's Media Director at the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, or MEAA. And Cassie's speaking with us about the protracted campaign by ABC staff to win job security, fair pay and improved conditions from the national broadcaster. And ABC staff are set to vote on potential strike action after yet another failure by ABC management to table a reasonable offer last week, with staff calls for action on ethical and accountable use of AI, respect for the MEAA Journalist Code of Ethics, and an audit into racial and disability pay gaps still going unheard. So make sure you stay tuned. 3CR Thursday Breakfast is on all the way through till 8:30 in the morning, and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
Over five decades, we've been home to hundreds of shows, thousands of broadcasters and guests, and hundreds of thousands of listeners.
This February, we're aiming for 1,000 subscribers.
It's just $40 concession, $80 full.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 19th of February. Ramadan has begun for many, and Palestinians in Gaza are forced to observe the start of the holy month amid severe shortages of food and clean water. Israeli attacks continue despite a declared ceasefire, leaving many Palestinians to organize their fasting around limited aid distribution. Now in occupied East Jerusalem, thousands of Palestinians pray at Al-Aqsa Mosque in the face of the aggressive Israeli security measures, including arbitrary arrests, entry bans, and general restriction of movement. And local news, Maribyrnong Council has announced it will transition away from a six-month trial in Footscray involving private security patrols. That has been heavily criticised by the local community and traders. Following an independent evaluation informed by over 700 community submissions and a council vote earlier this week, councils say the security presence will be scaled down in favour of a council-led presence and stronger coordination between traders, services and people in the community. Despite some community members and groups being excluded from council meetings and a number of public questions being deemed invalid for technical reasons, community mobilisation and public speakouts are credited with pushing council to invest in a more collaborative model developed with partners such as CoHealth and Mercy Health. Concerns still remain about the ambiguity of the new plan, with community members committing to keep up the fight and ensure that enforcement strategies are not maintained in another form.
Also in news this week, thousands of healthcare workers across Victoria went on strike yesterday, marking the third protected industrial action by members of the Health Workers Union after more than a year of stalled enterprise bargaining with the state Labor government. Following the strike, the government offered a 12% pay increase over 2.5 years, up from a previously rejected 9% offer, which will now be put to a vote of union members. Concerns remain from healthcare workers that back pay has not been guaranteed under the current agreement. In other news this week, the Australian Human Rights Commission has released its Racism at Uni study, with findings affirming that racism is widespread, systemic, and deeply embedded across universities in so-called Australia. Across more than 76,000 students and staff from over 42 institutions surveyed, 70% reported experiencing racism, including hearing or seeing racist behaviour directed at their community. Extremely high rates of racism are experienced by First Nations people, international students, and African, Asian, Jewish, Maori, and Palestinian and Pacifica respondents. Race Discrimination Commissioner Giridharan Sivaraman said the findings show universities are failing in their duty of care and called for urgent, coordinated reforms aligned with the national anti-racism framework. It's also important to note that the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network conducted a survey into racism at Australian universities that really showed the impact of anti-Palestinian and anti-Arab, as well as Islamophobic racism on Australian campuses. And also, I'm hoping that we'll be able to continue to unpack the way that racism and anti-racism is framed in so-called Australia and the different influences that are shaping this discussion. Finally, in headlines this week, environmental advocacy organizations are this week speaking out against state government's planned legislation to dismantle key environmental institutions such as the Victorian Environmental Assessment Council and the Victorian Marine and Coastal Council. Conservation groups urge the Allan government to scrap the bill, warning the move will silence science-based advice and oversight, weaken independent safeguards for habitats and wildlife, and leave nature vulnerable to short-term political pressures. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 12th of February, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 PM.
News and music from West Papua.
This is 3CR's Thursday Breakfast. It's currently 7:12. For our first segment, this is a rebroadcast of an exclusive interview aired on the 4th of February between Michael West of Michael West Media and human rights lawyer Chris Sidoti, discussing Australia's legal and moral duty in regards to the recent visit of Israeli Prime Minister Isaac Herzog. Take a listen.
And Chris, who, and we'll just title him as a prominent Australian international human rights lawyer, advocate and expert in national human rights institutions. He is currently a commissioner on the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestine territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. Welcome, Chris. You say that there is legal scope and perhaps a moral duty to arrest Isaac Herzog on arrival in Australia. Can you tell us why and on what grounds?
Yes, Michael. Legal scope and moral duty, both. The law is not beyond doubt, I have to say. In the past, it's been traditional that heads of state have immunity, head of state immunity, when travelling to foreign countries. But that old principle is being gradually broken down. And it's now argued by many international lawyers that head of state immunity doesn't apply to what are called atrocity crimes, that is, genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Our Commission of Inquiry has found that Herzog, the President of Israel, is responsible for incitement to genocide, which is one of these atrocity crimes. And so, in my view, head of state immunity doesn't apply to Herzog when he is visiting Australia because of this conclusion from the Commission that he is responsible for incitement to genocide. That means he should be arrested, he should be investigated. If there is evidence sufficient for prosecution, he should be prosecuted. Now, I would see that as a legal duty, but also as an ethical duty. Herzog is coming here, having made these incendiary statements himself, but also coming here as head of state of a rogue state. The Commission of Inquiry has been found by the International Court of Justice to be responsible for the unlawful occupation of Palestine, unlawful settlements in Palestine. The Israeli leadership has been found by the International Criminal Court to be subject to arrest and trial for crimes against humanity and war crimes. There is a genocide case against Israel before the International Court of Justice. There is plenty of evidence to say that the head of state of Israel, a rogue state, should not be welcome as a visitor to this country. So both on law and on ethics, I would argue that he should not be coming here. He should not have been invited. The invitation should be withdrawn. And if he comes, he should be arrested and investigated.
So he will be investigated under the Australian Criminal Code. Is that correct?
Both under the Australian Criminal Code and under international law. We do have provisions in our Criminal Code covering the crime of incitement to genocide. So it's an Australian crime. It's not just an international crime. But in the same way, it's a crime under international law. So the investigation can proceed under both bodies of law.
So some people are saying on social media that there's no grounds because of what you've mentioned, Chris, which is the fact that he's a ceremonial head of state rather than that it's not an executive position and therefore there's no grounds. But of course, we've all seen the horrors of Gaza and the West Bank, but particularly Gaza, unfold. And as yet, the International Court of Justice, these remain allegations, the genocide allegations. So they can always claim allegations, even though the evidence would seem to be the most overwhelming that anybody has ever seen, just to the naked, non-lawyerly eye. But what would you say are the main grounds that you have seen, the actual actions, apart from being the head of the rogue state? What are some of the things that Herzog has done which would be brought into evidence were he to be arrested and investigated?
The fact that he is ceremonial head of state only does not resolve every issue. It does resolve many issues. The powers of the Israeli president are similar to those of our own Governor General, broader but similar. And that means that the president of Israel does not have any role in the political or military chain of command. For that reason, because he's a ceremonial head of state, because he's not part of the political and military leadership, our commission has not found that he is responsible for war crimes or crimes against humanity. So that is one part of the story. But the other part of the story is what he has done personally. And that's where the question of incitement to genocide arises. He has made statements in which he has held the entire nation, was the phrase he used, Palestinians in Gaza, responsible for the crimes committed by Hamas in southern Israel on 7 October 2023. The entire nation was his expression. And in the context of the debates going on in Israel, that longer statement that he made, in our view, constituted incitement to genocide. Now, the fact that he's a ceremonial head of state does not excuse him from actions that he personally is responsible for and words which he personally has spoken. So in some senses, it's a furphy. It's a distraction to say that he's a ceremonial head of state and that absolves him of all responsibility. It does of some, but he is responsible for what he personally says and does.
Is there any historical precedent for this kind of action?
There certainly is historical precedent, particularly in the context of the International Criminal Court. The one case that I would refer to there is the case of the former president of Sudan, who was subject to an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. He travelled to South Africa in his capacity as head of state, and while he was in South Africa, the South African government was not willing to arrest him, but action was taken in the South African courts. And the South African courts ordered that the South African government arrest him if he was within the jurisdiction and subject to the warrant of the International Criminal Court. Now, he got out of the country before he was arrested. But there was a clear ruling by the court in that case that even though he was the head of state of Sudan, he was subject to arrest. There are differences in relation to Herzog. So far as we are aware, he is not subject to an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. He may be. I say so far as we are aware, because there's been no public statement from the court. But we do know that the court has issued warrants in relation to Netanyahu and Gallant, the former defence minister, And we do know that the court is continuing its investigations. We don't know whether further warrants have been issued. So he may be subject to an arrest warrant from the ICC. And if that's the case, the Australian government has a legal obligation to arrest him as soon as he sets foot in this country. But if there is no arrest warrant, then it's an obligation, in my view, under international law, customary international law, nonetheless, and a requirement to enforce the Australian Crimes Act.
So this subject of intent, which is absolutely intricate to the Geneva Convention and to international law, you're saying that Herzog has breached this because of his public statements saying that all people in Gaza should be subject to the same treatment, should be, I'm not sure of the exact words he used.
The entire nation is responsible, was what he said.
The entire nation is responsible, and we know on the very low figures so far that the conservative figures by the Hamas Health Ministry that 70,000 and a bit have been killed on their figures. That's bodies recovered. And we know that
the estimates recovered from... and identified, Michael. Mm. But also, last Thursday, the Israeli military admitted that they accepted the Hamas figures as the minimum death toll.
Now, which means it's far higher, that there's many more bodies buried under the rubble, which means that Francesca Albanese is positing figures as high as 680,000 and so on, given the immensity of the destruction there. And now that the IDF has admitted, Chris, that these figures are probably correct, because this was part of their PR platform for some time, that they just said, well, they're Hamas figures, so they can't be trusted. Yeah. Now they're saying we trust them. So do you think that that's an indication, a good indication the figures are far higher? What do you think that they are?
I wouldn't even put a guess on it, but yes, they are far higher, Michael. It's the identified bodies at this stage number almost 75,000. It's estimated that there are at least 100,000 buried under the rubble. There are also bodies that have been buried that were not identified or were not taken to the hospital or the morgue for identification, but were simply buried by their families. We have no idea how many of those there are. And then there are secondary deaths. These are just the deaths here that we're talking about that are the direct result of violence. There are other deaths, large numbers that are indirectly related. So the deaths from malnutrition, from starvation, preventable deaths due to disease, whether you're talking about people who could not get dialysis, for example, with kidneys, went into kidney failure and died, those who could not get cancer treatment, those who had heart conditions that were unable to be treated even with simple processes like stenting. So the number of preventable deaths that have occurred is also unknown. So when we say at least 75,000, we can be absolutely certain, in my view, that that figure is the bare minimum of the number of deaths from violence and does not take account of consequential deaths or preventable deaths that have occurred.
And so, Chris, the ceasefire. Now, just from a legal perspective, what you can see, they said there's a ceasefire in October. And since the ceasefire, of course, we've seen live footage of them actually bombing from the skies, people in tents. And so that would appear to be very genocidal. Certainly not, it's not showing much discretion, just bombing people from the skies. So, you know, 500 people is the number, I think, conservatively, which has been put on that death toll since the ceasefire. So what kind of ceasefire is it? I mean, the authorities and the Americans and Israelis claim that the ceasefire is holding, that they're doing the right thing. Of course, their credibility is looking thinner than ever. But what legally can we call this a ceasefire?
No, it's not a ceasefire. The most accurate description for it is reduced fire. The fire has reduced. The death toll, the daily death toll, has reduced. Since the reduced fire began, the average daily death toll of Palestinians is around about 5 persons per day. But there were 30 killed on Friday, 30. So some days it's very high, other days it's lower. But it's an average of around 5 people per day since the reduced fire began, which is about the same as the number of civilians killed each day in Ukraine, where there is no ceasefire or reduced fire at all. So we're talking about
here. It's accurate to say then that Australia has invited this guy who's potentially legally responsible for the genocide, while the genocide is still persisting. We've invited him to Australia on a tour. Is that correct?
I think that's an accurate description.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and that was a rebroadcast of an exclusive interview aired on the 4th of February between Michael West of Michael West Media and human rights lawyer Chris Sidoti discussing Australia's legal and moral duty in regards to the recent visit of Israeli President Isaac Herzog. And you can finish listening to that exclusive Michael West Media interview at Michael West Media. And we will put a special link in our show notes so that you can click and just resume the interview from where we left off. It is 7:26 in the morning and you're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast.
Quando sono solo in casa e solo devo restare.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio Filet.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English, so
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR 855 AM or you can listen online at 3cr.org.au.
Radio File.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR 855 and AM dial podcast, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. And now I'm joined by Matt Ruchel, who is the Executive Director of Victorian National Parks Association, who joins me for the second part of an interview on how the Victorian government has introduced legislation to dismantle key institutions that protect habitat and wildlife and silence expert voices. Now, part one of the interview played yesterday with Marty. So we really welcome Matt on the show for coming back again today. Welcome, Matt.
Pleased to be here.
I'm really excited to talk about it. And I wanted to follow on the conversation you had with Marty yesterday, where you spoke about, you know, the real history and the value of these organisations. But for people who didn't listen, could you key them in into why these organisations are so vital to safeguarding wildlife?
So there's two institutions on the chopping block, which is in legislation currently in the Parliament. One is the Victorian Environmental Assessment Council, which has been a body with its predecessors that's been around about more than 50 years. Its predecessors were things like bodies called the Land Conservation Council and the Environment Conservation Council, and then it was VAC from about 2001. And that's a body that, on the sort of request of government, would go and do sort of investigations and or provide advice on the use of public land. And it had a whole lot of statutory rules about, you know, periods of consultation, the need to test recommendations, the reports are tabled in Parliament, there's a requirement that the government would respond. Some of those things are being kept, but the council part, so the independent panel of experts, is being abolished. The second body is the Marine and Coastal Council, and it has been around since 2018, but there was a previous Coastal Council which goes back to the 90s, and it was a body of experts that informed the Victorian Coastal Strategy, or the Marine and Coastal Strategy, which is a strategy that sort of guides, you know, what you should and shouldn't do on the coast, influences some of the planning, but also talks about you know, some of the key issues, climate change, sea level rise, some of the impacts on habitat for the whole state. So they're very key institutions. And then there's a third part, which isn't in legislation yet, but is part of the government silver review, where they're reviewing a number of other key committees, like the Threatened Species Advisory Committee for the our main threatened species laws, and the National Parks Advisory Committee, which will also play a key role in safeguarding inappropriate development in national parks and protected areas.
Thanks so much for really, breaking it down. I am so curious as to why the government would want to get rid of expert guidance, particularly where there's more and more extreme weather events that we're seeing. Summer's getting hotter. We have, the reefs are really struggling in really like devastating consequential ways. What would be the reason or the political reason or the governmental benefit to getting rid of expert guidance and community input?
Well, the public message is that it's, cost saving and efficiencies to reduce the costs of public service, but they're not expensive institutions, only probably a couple of $1 million a year. And they're a bit surge based in the sense if the government's got work, specific work for them, they get funding. If not, they just tick along. So that's the sort of public excuse. I think it's hard to attribute. It's very perplexing. And in lots of ways, the government's sort of shooting itself in the foot because they're removing this expert advice, which creates a vacuum, and either we'll need to be relying on bureaucrats, which about 50% of the biodiversity people, including a lot of the marine people, have been sacked in recent cuts, or they can have to rely on consultants for key issues, which is not going to save them any money in the long term. So it's sort of this very perplexing sort of process of shooting yourself in the foot. The only sort of conclusion is that there's a sort of political imperative in the sense that, VAC's been a bit controversial. The National Party's had a long-standing policy that they wanted to get rid of it. The ALP seem to have adopted that.
Yep. Why would a Victorian Environmental Assessment Council be controversial?
Well, when they get into sort of talking about the future for public land, that always creates debate.
Right.
And that's always been the sort of case. And the process is really there to try and balance that debate. Listen to the community. There's various users of bits of public land. There's recreational interests, there's mining interests, there's agricultural interests that all want a piece of it. And then, of course, there's the interests of nature and, the broader community. And so that always creates a degree of debate. But that's the point. You need to have robust discussions about that to get a good outcome.
Yep. And I think having that robust discussion is so important to avoid, making continuously devastating, lasting impacts. And, from the sweeping review, from what I can see from the press release, that the entire council of experts from the Victorian Environmental Assessment Council and the Victorian Marine and Coastal Council will basically be stripped down to one commissioner for environmental sustainability. Is that right?
That's right. So the Commission for Environmental Sustainability is an independent office, but it's still one public service, with a small team of staff. They do things like our State of the Environment reports and that sort of thing. So I don't have a problem with that role in the current form, but it's not the same as having some of the leading sort of scientists and experts on either sort of nature conservation and public land use or marine and coastal issues providing advice. It's far from the same thing. Mm. So I think it's a real dumbing down and simplification of what is an incredibly complex area.
Yeah, thank you. So,
look, I suppose one of the drivers is that the government said there'll be no new national parks. That's what Jacinda Allen's declared post the declaration of Wombat Leeuwarden National Park in the Central West last year. But we've got a whole lot of international and national commitments. to continue to sort of create and complete the Victorian Reserve System. So while that's a short-term political decision, it shouldn't be a driver for destroying the institution that's really there to fill those gaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like with, you know, an election coming up and these short-term decisions, the sweeping reviews, it doesn't seem to, line up with what is vital for the land, the community, and the conservation groups. And I'm wondering, you know, you work across with so many people, and particularly, you know, with First Nations solidarity and nature conservation. I was wondering if they, during these discussions and putting out the media release, if they have been, really coming to the forefront of, like, this land is not being well taken care of. This is First Nations land. I'm wondering if, if you could, talk to that a little bit.
Well, I think there's a lot of, I think it's an area in flux. Like, there's incredible amount of value and a critically important role for traditional owners and First Nations to be engaged in public land management. And it's a very evolving area. So particularly with treaty and a whole lot of areas being handed over to joint management, which is important. So it's an area that's a bit in flux. And so that's one that, and I think really the challenge there is how do you mash together some of the sort of historical Western traditions of science and understanding and management of areas and emerging capacity amongst the traditional owner groups to do it. And so that needs really careful thought and it needs a lot of resourcing. Unfortunately, the levels of resourcing for management of public land are not increasing and already incredibly scarce. So I think that's the issue that sits at the crux of where we're going to go in the future.
Yep. And I really wanted to talk about how the this, like, annexing of these departments, what does that have the impact on, I guess, everyday people? Because I know it's, like, bureaucratically and there is, like, a trickle-down through legislation, but people live in these lands, they, you know, work in these environments, they're studying this. Like, what is the impact on everyday people?
Well, I think in terms of VAAC, like, they and their predecessors probably helped create, you know, a big chunk of the Victorian National Parks and Protected Area System. You know, places like the Grampians, the Alpine National Park, Yarra Ranges, you know, a whole lot of places went through these processes. Probably about 2 million hectares, you know, maybe half the National Park estate in Victoria. And they've certainly helped with making sure that the parks are well designed. And so it's Victoria has a complex public land system, and so one of the key things that needs to be balanced is ensuring that there's, you know, an areas put aside to protect nature, but also areas that are there for recreation. So the real trick with that is to try and identify, you know, the environmentally sensitive areas and make them appropriately protected, but also appropriately allow recreation in the less sensitive areas. So that's a real art, that. And so, you know, a lot of the places we enjoy for camping and so on have all been guided by these sorts of investigations. In the Marine and Coastal Council case, you know, Victorians love the coast. You know, a lot of us live, a lot of people live on the coast. It's a very dynamic environment. And so we're seeing sea level rise. We're seeing this process of particularly habitats on the coast being squished by property development on one side and rising sea levels on the other. While it's relatively slow moving, it's incredibly challenging and complex to try and navigate all of that. And at any day, you know, people might have seen the algal bloom in South Australia, or, you know, there's potential for oil spills. All of those things need really thoughtful response, and the marine environment is very complex and needs specialist knowledge. So lots of the, I suppose, you know, at a very basic level, structures, you know, where you access beaches, how do you deal with those sorts of issues are all guided by these sort of expert panels at the end of the day through the various strategies. And so what you'll end up is sort of dumbed down decisions is our concern.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, thinking about how we, I guess, fight back against this or support your, collective call to try to get this reversed or fight against it, what would you recommend for our listeners to learn more and particularly, like, do, because as you said, like, we live in the coast, we go camping, we go to the parks, we use the parks. This is part of our everyday life. And if this is, politicized and thrown away, it really threatens not just quality of life, but almost everything around us. I'm wondering how we can learn more and fight against this legislative change.
So there's a briefing paper, if you need a little bit more background, and a sort of petition or action letter on the BNPA website, so www.bnpa.org.au, and a number of other groups, of all the Wilderness Society, Environmental Justice Australia, and the Victorian Protected Areas Council. We're all working together to sort of pursue that. So please get that information. Feel free to talk to your local politicians and local members of parliament to raise your concerns. That's important that they hear that message, that people are concerned about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Matt, for coming on the show and, bringing to light such an important issue. And we'll leave all of that information in our show notes as well.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Matt Ruschel, the Executive Director of Victorian National Parks Association, who joined us for part two of the interview on how the Victorian government is introducing legislation to dismantle key institutions that protect habitat and wildlife and nature. That is nature, parks, coast, everything around us. We discussed the impact and how we fight against that on this interview, but in part one, on Wednesday Brekkie, Marty and Matt spoke about the history and the value of these organisations in greater detail. Message your local MP, and if you want to learn more, it's VN for Nelly PA, that's Victorian National Parks Association, and you'll see it at 3CR 8:55 AM.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community. Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 AM. It is 7:42 in the morning, and a quick weather check for today. It is predicted to be a maximum of 25 degrees right now outside. It feels like 12.9. It's supposed to be 14.4 degrees at the moment across NARM, and UV is very high, so make sure that you get that sun protection on between 9:50 and 5:10. Yes, I love the Bureau of Meteorology app, and I check it about 20 times a day, every single day. And now we are going to listen to an interview that I recorded earlier this week with Dr. Islam El-Habil, who is a garden engineer and Malaysia-based microplastics specialist. And Dr. El-Habil and I spoke about the silent cumulative harm that has been caused by the breakdown of plastic waste in Gaza during the ongoing genocide. Now, in this discussion, Dr. El-Habil elaborates on a piece that she recently authored for the Electronic Intifada titled The Toxic Legacy of Genocide. Beyond the immediate destruction of Israel's bombardment, Dr. El-Habil speaks about the everyday environmental and health impacts of a total breakdown in Gaza's waste management and plastic recycling capacities. Thank you for making the time to speak with me. I was hoping that you could begin by telling us about what plastic waste management looked like in Gaza before the genocide began in October 2023, because Israel had maintained a blockade of Gaza for quite a long time before that. So to what extent were Palestinians in Gaza able to establish and operate recycling facilities and waste management infrastructure before 2023?
Kitty, thank you so much for having me.
If you want to talk about the plastic waste management before October 2023 in Gaza, it was actually operated through the municipal collection system that transferred waste to the central landfills, sites like Johr el-Deek landfill, Deir el-Balah landfill, as well also Sofa landfill. But it was operated with very limited but also functioning separation and recycling activities, even despite the severe obstacles of the siege and obstacles from Israeli. So the municipalities and the small private workshops engaged in the basic material recovery, including like manual sorting of a plastic, like by the type, such as separating, for example, polyethylene bags and films from the containers, alongside also the recovery of the PET bottles, scarves, metals, cupboard, toys, glass, for example, also. And all of that types, it was, I have to focus that it was limited. And all of it, it happened, included yani, even the transfer station, where the waste was always compacted and partially sorted before the disposal. So all of that, it was happening usually by the informal pickers inside Gaza. Okay, and we can say that the ability to scale recycling infrastructure, important also modern equipment, for example, secure separation, or for example, unstable electricity, all of that, when we talk about it, it happened when Gaza did establish and operate elements of waste management and material recovery and under blockade conditions. The system also remained fragile, under-resourced, and highly vulnerable to disruption and destruction even before 2023. But at least they were trying in Gaza, and the municipalities, all of the facilities there, they were trying. It was some success stories about the separation, especially for some types of plastic, like when we say about toys or, as I mentioned, about PE. So it was some trials, good trials for the community under the siege. But all of that, when the war started 2023, everything collapsed.
I read your recent article for the Electronic Intifada, The Toxic Legacy of Genocide, and you talk about how this slower but quite profound violence of plastic pollution and of the breakdown of waste management systems in Gaza has affected the lives of Palestinians. So how has the genocide disrupted and changed waste management systems? And can you tell us about as well how the bombardment itself has accelerated some environmental risks for Palestinians through things like the breakdown of plastics and the release of toxic chemicals?
Actually, in my latest piece of the toxic legacy of the genocide, I describe how the destruction of the municipal infrastructure has collapsed already a fragile waste management system, halting regular collection and disabling the access to the landfills, because we know that our landfills, all of it, it's at the border of Gaza. So since the first day, we don't have any access to reach the landfills, even to the transfer station. And all of that, it forced the waste to accumulate in the streets, displacement shelters, and between the displaced people everywhere. And as well, also, it forced people to do the open burning also. And this open burning of the plastic or the other waste also type, it becomes like survival response rather than to be like option for them. So the bombardment itself compounds and accumulate the crisis itself. Explosions actually accumulate plastic in the tents, markets, municipalities, hospitals, everywhere around the displaced people. Also, while the destructed infrastructure, water tanks, pipes, toxic supplies, packaging everywhere. It was all distributed around the people, the displaced people, because also where the displaced people, they were in the very small area, very small tents. They were all always forced to go to the south. So the south, it was very crowded with displaced people, very crowded with accumulated waste. That accumulated waste, actually, it break down into the fine particles. That fine particles, it's very toxic. It's not only microplastic, it's microplastic. It's another toxic also residues. And all of that fine particles under actually the heat and diffractions, sunlights, all of this accumulation, let's say condition, all of it, it convert it to very hazardous actually waste. So when we talk about the plastic itself, when the plastic burn or the plastic degrade under all of these extreme conditions, so that's meaning it release microplastic and it release very fine particles and hazardous, not only microplastic, also organic compounds. All of that accumulate in the air, also enters our soil into the water, and after that into our bodies through the inhalation, ingestion, all of that way. So in this way, we can say that the violence itself, it's not only like immediate or explosive, but also slow and cumulative. So the exposed to the toxic into daily, yani this exposed to the toxic into our, yani their daily life, it becomes like it will give them like long-term impact, long-term effect. It's not only about today. And for example, we are talking about 2 years of genocide. It's not 2 years of genocide. Actually, it's cumulative and long-term exposure.
Yeah, I mean, as you've outlined, we're going to see these impacts for generations because of the very slow and silent way that, you know, this violence occurs. And it is something that is not really captured in the conversations that we're having. You know, mainstream media is not really covering very much in general, but even in the conversations that we are having about the genocide internationally, there is a focus, and it's understandable, on the immediate bombardment, but also thinking about the broader conditions of life is so important, and the future of Palestinians in Gaza. Now, you mentioned that people have had to resort to burning plastics as a survival mechanism, not because they want to. And can you talk about how that relates to the restriction of fuel and then the impacts that this is having on people in displacement camps?
It's very good to mention that Israel cut off the fuel and the electricity since 9 October 2023. That's meaning the third day of the genocide, there is no power at all in Gaza. 0%. So when the fuel and the electricity are cut off, so the burning becomes, as I mentioned, survival. It's not optional. So it turned actually all of the tents, all of the shelter into exposure zone to the plastic toxic area, very, very hazardous, yani very hazardous waste. So the plastic doesn't actually, as we know, it doesn't burn clearly, especially when it burns in the open area. And because we don't have any power, we don't have any electricity, so the people, they need to heat the water, they need to heat the food, they need to cook, they don't have any fuel. So it was their own optional. And they know, they are very educated people. They know that it will release yani very small and fine particles, and at the end it will enter deeply into their lungs, and it will not be only plastic and microplastic. It will be along with carbon monoxide, with complex mix of the, as I mentioned, toxic organic compound, but they don't have any other option. So in the short term, people experiences there, they experience coughing, they experience wheezing, eye and throat irritation, as well headaches, dizziness. All of that, it was short term. But when we want to talk about long term, we can mention about cancers, about very, 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 let's say, severe very severe illness. So because also there is very new and recent studies mentioned that they found microplastic particles inside the cancer cells. So this one, it's very dangerous. But when you don't have any option, you will do it because you think that you save yourself for the short time, but actually you are killing yourself in the long time. And Israel doesn't leave any option for the people there. Also very good to mention that it's about children, about older people, about also those who have heart and lung also diseases. All of these people, they were affected and they were in the first line, yani, who are affected because of that. Also, the longer arc, yani, is more dangerous about that. Repeated the exposure, it's not only about the exposure only, it's repeated the exposure to these fine particles actually will increase the risk, yani, of chronic respiratory illness. And while certain composition byproducts, such as, for example, organic toxin and polycyclic aromatic also, carbon monoxide, I mentioned about that. All of that also, it has like adverse impact, not only on the older people, also pregnant women, for example. We are talking about children, about infant inside these tents. All of them, they exposed to this open area. And as I mentioned at the beginning, they forced all of the people to be at the very limited area at the south. So they all surrounded with each other. So the infant, he's inside the lab of his mom while his mom is cooking, is exposing directly to this plastic, microplastic burning. So it's like one circle, closed circle. We run from this side to that side, but it's closed circle actually. And we all exposed to that danger.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that paints a really vivid and terrifying picture of what Palestinians in Gaza are being forced to navigate every day. And then on the other side of that is, of course, in an ongoing genocide, there's been a lack of access to medical care and medical supplies coming in, and things like cancer care and chronic health condition management. And so, you know, Israel's blockade of those kinds of facilities being reestablished and properly resourced, then you can see how that'll compound the impacts into the future. I wanted to ask you about the suggestion that it's impossible to fight for global environmental justice without fighting for the freedom and justice of Palestine and the Palestinian people. What do you think about this? Because, you know, it always strikes me as strange when I hear environmental justice conversations happen without talking about the genocide.
Actually, environmental justice is a core. It's about who, yani, it's about who bears environmental harm and who controls the environmental resources. So it's about the exposure, access to clean water, energy, land, air, and decision maker also. So if we take the definition seriously, then the situation where a population lacks of high authority of their water, of their land, of their electricity, of all of the sources. So it's aren't marginal to the environmental justice. Actually, it's the central. It's the central to them. And in that sense, it's very good also to mention that arguing about the justice, yani, the environmental justice, must include always the justice of Palestinian rights. A people who cannot actually meaningfully seek to sustainability or climate resilience, while we can say, while denied basic control over the environmental infrastructure and mobility as well. It's about the power, as I mentioned, the power who controls the input like fuel, materials. We mentioned that Israel cut off the power since the beginning. It's about also who controls the output, the waste. We cannot even have any access to our landfills to dump our waste. who has the control for the recovery, reconstructions. We are talking about reconstruction. We don't have any power to have the permission to enter any material, any machinery, anything to start to rebuild or reconstruction. So actually, sustainability without political freedom, it's nothing. It's nothing. And history actually shows that the environmental harm often follows lines of the power. So who has the power? Who always have the control? This is the point. So my question is whether the global movement are willing to see that pattern clearly.
It's a powerful question, and I think one that we all need to be asking ourselves, especially people in the global north who are, you know, who have the luxury of being selective. But actually, this is thinking about everything as a system. And if we can't see our lives as mutually implicated, then we're missing the point. Look, Dr. Elhabil, thank you so much. I wanted to ask if there's anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap up.
Actually, only one point. I want always to ask the listener not to look to Gaza as a humanitarian only crisis. It's also ecocide. Ecocide doesn't agree with any of the international environmental roles. Even when we talk about international roles, let's start with Geneva itself. This ecocide inside Gaza, it doesn't agree with any of these international actually rules. So finally, actually, the solidarity in the environmental justice means consistency. So if we believe every community has the right to have the access to their clean water, safe water, control on all of their resources, then that principle must apply everywhere without exception. At the end, I can say that justice cannot be selective. Justice cannot be selective, and sustainability as well cannot be built on exclusion.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful, and I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your time, all of the efforts. Happy to be with you.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass instruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is currently 8:03, and now we are joined by Josh Fear, who's the National Policy Director of Palliative Care Australia, speaking to us about the backing of the latest calls to expand the Commonwealth PRAC payment to end placement poverty for medical and allied health students. Thanks so much for joining us here today, Josh.
G'day.
Thanks so much. I wonder if we could just break down the PRAC payment right now that commenced last year in July. It was nursing, midwifery, teaching and social work students. But why is it important to include medical and allied health students, particularly in this expansion?
Well, there's all sorts of parts of the workforce that are under pressure. The health workforce in particular, although, of course, teachers aren't part of the health workforce. So if we just restrict it to nursing and social work students in health, which is kind of what's happening at the moment, then we've got all vast ways of the workforce, which we're not supporting, to study the courses that we need them to study so that we can supply the workforce of tomorrow.
Yeah. I know, you know, particularly with palliative care, which I really wanted to talk about, is how multidisciplinary it is and how important it's been, for the PRAC payment to help support end some level of placement poverty, even though it's really not always enough. But when you're working in palliative care in a multidisciplinary team. Can you speak to a little bit of the work that palliative care workers or nurses or, yeah, social workers do?
Sure. Well, I guess most people understand what a doctor does and maybe what a nurse does, but the palliative care team is much bigger than that. It includes social workers, occupational therapists, even paramedics who often might arrive at someone's house when they're having a pain crisis, for example, but they've said they don't want to go to hospital. It's often paramedics on the front line of those kinds of situations. You've got spiritual workers as well.
Yeah, very important.
Not just religious. Palliative care is about a holistic approach that covers the full suite of needs that someone has in their final weeks, days, months. Of course, that takes people with lots of different kinds of skills. Often it's people die in or recently in an aged care facility, and so there are aged care skills as well, and aged care providers have a new obligation under law to provide palliative care and end-of-life care to their residents. So, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even as a social work student that has graduate that has been on multiple placements, there were so many days where I'm like, I don't know where I'm going to be able to eat. I had to work two jobs to try to even save up to go unpaid for this amount of time. And for, you know, medical and allied health workers, it's also the same. And seeing the survey that says, you know, the Health Alliances survey, that over 42% of health students went hungry while on placement. Like, this is not uncommon across the sector. But what impact does this have on people that are trying to learn and educate themselves, try to come into the field as well as into palliative care?
Well, yeah, the story you've just told us briefly is so common. And it's a little bit silly that we've got to this point, expecting us to have a viable workforce, complaining about workforce shortages, and yet forcing students to go through these kinds of experiences just to do the basic requirements of their course. It's pretty silly. Social workers can access this payment now. The campaign that's going on is all about expanding the number of courses and professions that can attract a Commonwealth PRAC payment. I guess it would be students studying in rural areas that where we often hear this is an issue.
Definitely.
They're needing to travel for their placements, often a long way from home. And, of course, people on low incomes who might have to drop out, save up, maybe never come back to it.
Yep.
It's all pretty silly, and it's also avoidable.
Absolutely, it is so avoidable. There is clearly the money there, and I think I really wanted to touch on the fact that the medical and allied health sector so often, you're doing massive, overworked amount of days in regional, remote, in underpaid. Hospitals. And I just wanted to, think about why, how we can better support the students as well as supporting the backing for this call.
I guess there's a lot we can do more broadly to support students studying these kinds of professions. This is a start. But there's a lot of social issues that we could talk about, housing, broader income support for students, cost of living stuff, I guess that's out of the scope for what's happening right now with this campaign, but this is just one contribution we can make.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an important contribution. And if people wanted to know more about Palliative Care Australia and, this call to expand the PRAC payment to medical and allied health students to end placement poverty, how can we learn more?
Oh, look, if you want to find out about palliative care, then feel free to head to our website, which is palliativecare.org.au. But the campaign is actually being promoted by an organisation called Allied Health Professionals Australia. So if you want to sign the petition, get behind the campaign, I'd suggest heading to their website, Allied Health Professionals Australia.
Yep, no worries. We'll put that in our show notes as well. But thank you so much, Josh, for coming on the show and talking about, you know, a really important issue that affects so many students and people and, the people that are going to be involved in palliative care.
Thanks for the chance to chat. Cheers.
Thank you. And that was Josh Fear, the National Policy Director of Palliative Care Australia, speaking to me about the backing of the latest call to expand Commonwealth PRAC payment to end placement poverty for medical and allied health students. We unpacked why this is so important. It helps remove barriers to access and education and just continuity of care throughout palliative care. And it comes after a recent survey showing that 42% of health students have gone hungry while in placement. And this is not uncommon for, across the sector.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are coming up to our final interview for today's program. We are joined now by Cassie Derrick, Media Director at the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, or MEAA. And Cassie is speaking with us about the protracted campaign by ABC staff to win job security, fair pay and improved conditions from the national broadcaster. ABC staff are set to vote on potential strike action after yet another failure by ABC management to table a reasonable offer last week, with staff calls for action on ethical and accountable use of AI, respect for the MEAA Journalist Code of Ethics, and an audit into racial and disability pay gaps going unheard. Now, Cassie has worked alongside MEAA members for over 5 years in the positions of media organizer, organizing director, and deputy director of the media section, as well as organizing workers at Professionals Australia, the CFMEU, and Unions New South Wales. And she was appointed director of media in October 2022. Good morning, Cassie.
Good morning, Priya.
Thanks very much for joining us. Now, I wanted to begin by asking you about the conditions of workers at the ABC. So can you give us a picture of the ABC's workforce and general work conditions and how this has changed over recent years, including an increase in short-term contracts and reducing job security?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the ABC has a very large workforce, as it should, as you know, the national broadcaster with 62 bureaus and a lot of obligations to the Australian public. And one thing that they have done over recent years, I think as a way to try and deal with the budget constraints that came after a decade of coalition government, was to, they've done about 8 restructures in recent years in which they have sacked a lot of experienced and well-paid journalists and content makers, and then replaced those secure, well-paid, experienced roles with short-term contracts, much lower pay, and a much more insecure workforce. And that's the flow-on effect of that is much higher churn, much lower morale, and a workforce that is really, really struggling to do what it needs to do for the Australian public.
And I understand that journalistic practice, it's a craft, it's a skill that you develop over time. And if you are, jumping from short-term contract to short-term contract, it's really hard to get that continuity to develop, your capabilities as a broadcaster, as a writer, as a producer. And, you know, I wanted to ask about the question of racism, given the context of last year's unlawful termination case that was brought by Antoinette Latouf and then the ABC's subsequent social media policy overreach. What intent exists at the ABC to genuinely address racism within and outside interference of the organisation as well? Because issues of racism and discrimination have come up in negotiations with management.
Yeah, I think racism is a huge problem at the ABC. We've got an organisation that has increased the diversity of its journalists in an attempt to reflect the Australian public, 50% of whom have at least one parent born overseas, but they haven't actually fixed the structures internally. So we've got, as you sort of go up the ranks into management positions and executive positions, it becomes increasingly white and increasingly, I suppose, old-fashioned media culture. And so it has led to quite an unsafe workplace where we have diverse, extremely dedicated journalists from all sorts of backgrounds who are in insecure work, low pay, and dealing with a culturally unsafe workplace. There have been numerous reviews, and we have also done a lot of work with our membership to try to figure out what is the most effective way to deal with the problem. What we find generally is that there's times in which the ABC is happy to address some of the issues, but when it comes to that real structural inequality that's baking in that problem, they're not addressing it.
Yeah, and I mean, that is really concerning, considering that there's such a massive power imbalance between workers on short-term contracts and people at the top who have, long-term positions, but are also in a position to make those big calls about whether, people at the bottom are actually being treated fairly and, how disposable they're considered within the organization. I wanted to also ask about concerns about press freedom and how they've surfaced in negotiations between ABC workers and the national broadcaster, and maybe to ask a bit about this relationship between press freedom and job security, as well as journalistic ethics.
It's a really good question. I think that a lot of people have seen over the course of a number of years some really concerning interventions from outside groups into the ABC, and it is the job of the board and of the managing director of the ABC to protect the editorial independence of our broadcaster, so that we as the public can be confident that it is delivering on its charter and on the trustworthy news that we come to expect of it. There has certainly been times, especially you mentioned Antoinette Latouf before, there's certainly been times in recent years where they have failed in their role to do that. There has been a lot of work done by the workforce to try to hold the line on that. It is an essential part of, I suppose, our role as the union to ensure that our members are safe and protected in doing their jobs. That requires job security. And it requires knowing that your manager is going to have your back when someone externally is trying to put pressure on them to quiet down a story that might, be speaking truth to power.
Absolutely. And, I wanted to come back to that question of, these multiple restructures that have happened over the past decade or so and organizational mismanagement. And then you know, the worker conditions we've discussed and how this all impacts on the quality of media that the ABC is able to produce. Can you talk about some of the downstream impacts that we've already seen on our media landscape and what workers are concerned about if this trend continues?
Our members at the ABC, they take their role in delivering the most trustworthy news and content and also brave storytelling to their audience. They take that responsibility very, very seriously. But I think when you're in a situation where you're on a short-term contract, you don't know if you're going to have a job next month, it is very hard to concentrate on doing that brave and public interest journalism when instead, you're worried about making sure that you can find another job in a couple of weeks, making sure that you're not going to, you know, upset anyone and potentially lose your income and your ability to keep doing the work.
Mm. And it's quite a constrained media landscape that we have, you know, considering, the Murdoch monopoly over so much of the private media sector and then all of these cuts to public media. Is there anything else you wanted to comment on about, the ABC workers' struggle within the broader media landscape in Australia?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. We've got a media landscape in which there are a small number of very powerful operators that have a huge amount of market share. And then we've got a cohort of working journalists that see the work they do as a public service. And so there is a bit of a push and shove between that. You know, working journalists have an editorial code and an ethical code that they want to hold the line on and make sure that what they are doing is that essential work that we all need to make sure that, corporate wrongdoing and parliaments and courts and climate and all sorts of things are reported on and we know what's going on, at the same time as being constrained by a highly concentrated media landscape with some very powerful employers that are often influenced by commercial interests. So the role of our ABC in that of a public broadcaster that doesn't have to worry about commercial interests is critical, and that's why the workers internally are absolutely holding the line and standing up for it.
Absolutely. You know, this is the organisational protection and being able to come together and produce public interest journalism together is worth fighting for when we're talking about an environment where these downward pressures is leading to, you know, proliferation of journalists, you know, going independent and doing independent media production. But there is extreme value in being able to come together within an organisation and have, you know, more distributed responsibilities to be able to cover a broader variety of topics and to be able to really engage in that vital reporting that we all rely on to understand what's happening in the world around us. So coming back to the staff vote, staff are voting this week on taking protected action in the face of the ABC's ongoing refusal to come to the table with a reasonable offer. What should we be keeping an eye out for? And would you like to send a message to any ABC employees that are tuning in?
Well, my message to any ABC employees is that your union absolutely has your back. And we're really looking forward to being able to reset the tone in the workplace so that the workforce, who are the ones that do the work that the Australian public need, have a say, have the security they need and are able to build sustainable careers. For everyone else, for members of the public like me, there's 62 bureaus of the ABC. There's going to be one near you. It's very, very likely that in the coming few weeks they're going to be going out on strike and they need you to have their back. So if you see any of our communications, make sure you're sharing it. If you have an opportunity to go down and, clap them out, that would be an enormous help to demonstrate to your local ABC journalists and content makers, as well as to management, to the government, that actually what Australians want and need is an ABC with the quality jobs that quality journalism demands.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Cassie, and we will keep an eye out for any strike action calls and share that information with our listeners. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much.
And that was Cassie Derrick, media director at the MEAA, who spoke with us about the protracted campaign by ABC staff to win job security, fair pay, and improved conditions from the national broadcaster. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Hi,
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Well, we are coming to the end of our program this week on Thursday Morning Breakfast. But before we let you go, we will give you a little rundown of what we talked about. So first up, we rebroadcast part of an exclusive Michael West Media interview with human rights lawyer Chris Sidoti on Israeli President Herzog's recent visit to Australia. And we'll have a link in our show notes where you can pick up from where we left off in the interview.
And then you heard from Matt Rochelle, who is the Executive Director of Victorian National Parks Association, for part two of our interview, collaboration with Wednesday Brekkie, shout out Marty, just about how the government has introduced legislation to dismantle key institutions that protect nature, and that's coast, life, park, everything that we exist in. And then
we heard an interview that I recorded earlier this week with Dr. Islam El-Habil, who's a Gazan engineer and Malaysia-based microplastics specialist. And we spoke about the silent cumulative harm that has been caused by the breakdown of plastic waste in Gaza during the ongoing genocide. And we'll have a link to Dr. El-Habil's article on the Electronic Intifada titled The Toxic Legacy of Genocide in our show notes.
And then we were joined by Josh Fear, the National Policy Director of Palliative Care Australia, speaking to us about backing the latest calls to expand the Commonwealth PRAC payment to end placement poverty, particularly for medical and allied health students. And we unpacked why it was important to remove these barriers to education, and particularly in palliative care and how this impacts everybody, and how, yeah, palliative care is often really neglected in this sense.
Yeah, and finally, we were joined, as you just heard, by Cassie Derrick, who is the media director at the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, speaking about the campaign by ABC staff to win better job conditions from the national broadcaster. And as we just wrapped up with, ABC staff are set to vote on potential strike action after yet another failure by ABC management to table a reasonable offer last week. So we will be keeping an eye out for upcoming strike action. And yeah, just really important to support wresting back public control of the national broadcaster. It is so rare to be able to access the kind of incredible quality independent journalism that you get on 3CR. So be good to see that in other places, I reckon.
Absolutely. Subscribe now.
Exactly. This is the last day of our subscriber drive, but you can subscribe anytime this year, anytime you like, whenever feels financially sensible to you. And remember, this is not a donation. This is a subscription where you become part of the 3CR community. In a more formal way, you get to, for example, put your hand up to be involved in station governance via the Station Worker and Subscriber Committee. And subscription prices range from $40 for concession, $80 waged, $150 for bands and organizations, or even $300 for solidarity subscriptions if you're feeling particularly generous. So to subscribe, remember you can visit 3cr.org.au or call the station during business hours on 94198377. That is all we've got for you today. So stay safe and we'll catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast.
See ya.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.